Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. It's Thursday. It's open forum. If you have a question about the Catholic faith, your question is welcome here. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Our number is 888-318-7884. Open forum means open to everyone, whether you're Catholic or not Catholic, and open to any question having to do with the Catholic faith. And today, we'll probably be broad in our acceptance of questions. If you've got a question of a more generally philosophical or religious nature, it doesn't have to just be something specific to the Catholic faith. Those are welcome as well, because our guest this hour and next is one of Santa's favorite elves, Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. Hi, Jimmy.
How are you doing, Cy?
I am very well. I am actually in a state of delight right
now. Oh, good. Good for you. That's always nice.
Because of your magnificent Christmas outfit that you're wearing right now.
So would you care to describe it for the people on radio?
I would see us. I would describe, first of all, a red-headed bearded man.
Sure.
Wearing a green shirt, red pants.
Yeah.
A red jean jacket.
Uh-huh.
A red, what do we say, necktie, kerchief?
Kerchief, necktie, ascot.
Ascot,
kind of
okay.
Like that.
Yeah. And a green shirt.
Mm-hmm.
And just looking
at... No, just one green shirt.
Yes.
Yeah.
Just one green shirt.
You mentioned it at the beginning and the end.
Oh, so. I did. Oh, sorry.
Didn't want people to think I'm wearing two green shirts.
You look like Christmas came to life.
Thank you.
It's magnificent. Have other people commented?
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
That's good.
No, it's a bit of a change because normally, ever since I lost all the weight that mm-hmm. I had been striving to lose, I said I'm not going to hide in dark colors anymore, and so I've been wearing white. I've been wearing white pants and a white jacket. And
right.
A while back, I was out and I saw someone wearing red pants and I thought, oh, red pants had never occurred to me. So I ordered some of those. I ordered a red jacket. And I've worn this outfit before, although with a red shirt, because I was going to an...
That is very red.
Yeah.
That's a lot of red.
There was a reason, because I was going to an English country dance for Halloween that was themed as Come Dressed as a Dance.
Oh.
And so I came dressed as the English country dance from about 200 years ago, red and all red.
Boy, did you.
But then I said, oh, I can put a green shirt with this and I can have a Christmas outfit. So that's what I'm wearing today. And you can see it on streaming. You go to the Catholic Answers YouTube channel or whatever after the show and check it out. Or I'm going to put it on. I had Tim Ryland take a picture of me in the hallway of Christmas just outside the radio studio.
Which Marie did.
Yeah.
Assistant about producer that? Marie did a magnificent job. Oh, sorry, and Darren. Darren helped too, right?
Yeah. But I'm going to put that up on Facebook on Christmas Day and wish everyone a Merry Christmas.
I'm merry already. It's not even Christmas yet, and I already feel merry. Again, 888-318-7884, the number. Lots of people on the line, so we will start taking calls. Matt from Denver, Colorado, listening on 1060 AM. You start us off today. Your question for Jimmy.
Yeah, hello, guys. I do have a question regarding the Eucharist. And how many times can you receive it in one day? For instance, if I was to go to 7 a.m. Mass and received it, could I then go to 5 p.m. Mass and receive it again?
Mm-hmm. You could do that. The way canon law is written and the way it's been interpreted by the Pontifical Council for Legislative Texts is that you can receive communion apart from danger of death. If danger of death gets involved, you can receive another time. But apart from danger of death, an ordinary person can receive communion up to twice a day, provided that the second time you are participating in a Mass. The first time could be just a communion service, or you could just be walking through a church when they're celebrating Mass, but you're not really there participating. But the second time, you need to be participating in the context of a Mass.
How's that, Matt?
Okay, so yeah, just clarification on that. So if I went to the full Mass in the morning and the full Mass again at night,
mm-hmm.
then could I still receive? Yeah.
That's right. That would be up to twice a day. The requirement is the second time must be a Mass you're participating in. If you're also participating in a Mass the first time, that is fine.
Thanks, Matt. Thanks for that question. I think a lot of Catholics will be surprised that you can receive communion even though you have not attended the fullness of the Mass. I think
people find that surprising.
Yeah, and I maybe have been taught different things about that. But as you said, so you're walking
there,
by.
There is no requirement in the law that says you must have been at Mass from any certain point up until communion time in order to receive communion. You could literally be walking through church and join the communion line and leave church. Now, that would not fulfill your Sunday obligation.
Okay.
Your Sunday obligation requires you to participate in a Mass, but there is not a requirement that you experience any particular amount of the Mass in order to receive communion, as illustrated by the fact you can receive communion entirely outside of Mass, such as at a communion service.
Indeed. All right. Matt, a great question to start us off with. Thanks very much for that question. Let us go now to Aaron in Illinois, listening on 95.9 FM. Aaron, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hi, Jimmy. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to ask who King Solomon and Queen Bathsheba's steward was, the steward who had the keys to the kingdom and the power of binding and loosing and all that. Who was King Solomon and Queen Bathsheba's steward?
Well, so the master of the palace or chief steward or however you want to translate it was an institution that was common in royal courts in the ancient Near East. And so we know that there was such an individual in the case of the Davidic kingdom, because we later in Isaiah even learn the names of a few men who occupied this office. I'm not aware of a biblical passage that says who it was during Solomon's day. There may be one, but I'm not aware of it. In terms of the Queen of Sheba, now obviously she's not from Israel. She's from a land to the south, it seems. We're not exactly sure where. But she would have had her own royal court. And if it followed the same customs as other nations in the area, or at least other nations in the ancient Near East, then she would have also had a master of the palace or chief steward that oversaw the affairs of the palace in her absence. But that is not recorded in Scripture, I'm pretty sure. And we don't otherwise have records of her kingdom. We're not even sure which her kingdom hers was.
I'm pretty sure that the Queen of Bathsheba was a different person.
Queen Bathsheba, that's different. Okay, yeah. I misheard you. I thought you said the Queen of Sheba. No, Bathsheba was originally the wife of Uriah the Hittite, and then after David encompassed the death of Uriah the Hittite, David married her, and she was the mother of Solomon. So she didn't have her own master of the palace. The master of the palace would have been employed initially by her husband David and then by her son Solomon once he became king. And over that lengthy span of time, there probably would have been more than one master of the palace. But as I said, I'm not sure if Scripture records the name of that official at this time or not. I'd have to do further research.
Thanks, Aaron. Thank you very, very much. 888-318-7884, the number. It's open forum today on Catholic Answers Live. It's also Advent. Maybe you got a question about Advent. Maybe you got a question about the sacraments. Maybe a question about can you attend Mass on Christmas Day, or anything having to do with the Catholic faith is welcome. And when Jimmy's here, we usually expand that out a little bit. If you have a question of a more generally religious or philosophical nature, we're happy to take that as well. 888-318-7884. 888-318-7884 is the number. You can still save money on hundreds of items in our online shop. You just enter CALIVE18 at checkout when you visit shop.catholic.com to save 30%. Off hundreds of books and DVDs and CDs, including Jimmy Akin's brand new book, Teaching with Authority. We've extended this discount through the end of the year, but act now. Those prices go away January 1st. 30% off at shop.catholic.com if you use the promo code CALIVE18.
Have a question? We've got answers.
Catholic Answers.
Love it.
Live. Catholic Answers Live is brought to you in part by CatholicSingles.com, the website for Catholics who want to meet others who share their faith and values for faith, fellowship, and love. You can learn more at CatholicSingles.com. Catholic Answers Live thanks CatholicSingles.com for their generous support.
Homeschool Connections, an online provider of courses for your Catholic homeschool, is a sponsor of Catholic Answers Live. Homeschool Connections website is homeschoolconnections.com.
I'm Jeanette DeMello, editor-in-chief of the National Catholic Register and co-host of Register Radio with Matthew Bunsen. Join us every week as we talk with the Register's expert writers and editors about the news you need to know, and offer authentic Catholic insights on the important stories that impact your life. Register Radio, every Saturday at 7 p.m. Eastern and Sunday at 11 a.m. Eastern, here on EWTN Global Catholic Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, open forum. Jimmy Akin, our guest this hour. Your questions welcome at 888-31-TRUTH. On the line, we have Sarah from Rochester, New York, listening on the Station of the Cross. Sarah, your question for Jimmy.
Hi.
Hi.
Good evening. I have a question about contraception.
Okay.
My husband and I just became Catholics this Easter Vigil.
Congratulations.
And I – thank you. And we've been married for about a year and a half, and I – have medical condition. Polycystic ovarian syndrome and a...
I'm sorry, I missed that. Could you say that again? What kind of condition do you have?
It's called polycystic ovarian syndrome,
okay,
or PCOS,
mm-hmm,
and then type 2 diabetes.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm unmanaged. So my blood sugar is... I'm working on it, but my blood sugar is out of range.
Oh.
So my doctors have said that I can't get pregnant or it could endanger me or the baby.
Okay.
So my question is am I, and I have conflicting thoughts on it,
mm-hmm,
but my husband is adamant in abstinence for now,
mm-hmm,
because he doesn't believe in birth control.
Mm-hmm.
But if I were to take birth control, would that, I know that there's a sin attached to it,
mm-hmm,
but would that sin transfer to my husband if I'm the one that's participating in that, I guess, is the best way to ask that.
So, there's sort of two questions here. So I'm going to answer the second question first, and then I'm going to look at the issue from a little broader perspective. In terms of if one spouse is committing a sin, like birth control, as long as the other spouse is not being required to do anything wrong, like use birth control him or herself, then the spouse who's not using birth control is not engaging in something sinful, as long as he or she makes it clear to the spouse that is using birth control at appropriate times that that this is something that God doesn't want and that we need to find another solution to. And he doesn't have to say that every single time, but, you know, he needs to not lend the impression that he approves of what's going on. And secondly, there needs to be a serious reason for going ahead and maintaining marital relations, even though one spouse is contracepting, and that can be a reason like we need to do this in order to have our marriage hang together or to avoid some other kind of, you know, sin that might happen if we weren't fulfilling our marital duties to each other. That subject is discussed in a document known as the Vademecum for Confessors. It was put out by the Holy See a few years ago, and it's available online at the Vatican website. Vademecum is spelled V-A-D-E-M-E-C-U-M. You can come back and watch the show online or download the MP3 to get that spelling. So that's the question that's the answer to the question that you posed. It's not necessarily a sin for your husband if you're using contraception and you're having marital relations. There are a few conditions that need to be fulfilled in order protects sin from happening in that situation. But that's the answer to the question as posed. Now let's look at the broader situation. This is something that is contrary to God's will. Now, if there are some situations in which one can, for example, use a medical procedure that has a contraceptive effect, for example, if it turned out that the easiest way or the best way to deal with polycystic ovarian syndrome was to take certain hormones, and if it also happened that that the hormones would prevent you from ovulating, then assuming the polycystic ovarian syndrome is problematic enough, and well, then it wouldn't be a sin to take the hormones. Because in that case, you're not taking the hormones to avoid getting pregnant. You're taking the hormones to treat the polycystic ovarian syndrome. And so the fact that it also prevents you from ovulating is a side effect. It's not a goal you're pursuing, and it's not a means to achieving another goal. It's just purely a side effect. And side effects like not ovulating and consequently not being fertile can be tolerated for a sufficient reason, like if you have a serious medical condition that needs to be treated. So I don't know the treatment for polycystic ovarian syndrome, but if it did involve taking the pill, which is really just hormones, then it could potentially be justified. It wouldn't actually be an act of contraception in that case. It would be an act of treating the polycystic ovarian syndrome, and it would have a contraceptive effect as a side effect, but it wouldn't be an act of contraception. The other one you mentioned was type 2 diabetes. And when you said your blood sugar currently is out of range, I initially thought you might have meant off the charts, and I hope that's not it. If it were, you probably would be in the hospital and not talking to me. I assume you just mean out of the normal range. Well, diabetes is also a serious medical condition that needs to be treated. But there are other – number one, there are ways of managing it, even for people who are diabetic all the time and who get pregnant. It is not automatically – life-ending or health-ending for either the mother or the child in those situations. There are diabetic women who get pregnant and who are able to manage the condition through the pregnancy successfully. So even though there is a tendency in our culture for doctors, usually for reasons of they're afraid of getting sued, They don't value human life and children as much as they should. There's a tendency to kind of scare people away from getting pregnant in these situations. And I would consult with a pro-life doctor and say, look, what are the real risks here and what are the real treatment options? Also, in terms of diabetes, I would suggest – this is not medical advice, of course, but I would suggest that you check out the work of a man. He's a Canadian doctor named Jason Fung, F-U-N-G, and he has written and also has some YouTube videos, but he's written a book called The Obesity Code that deals with the science underlying diabetes and how it can be dramatically improved. And so I would suggest you check out Jason Fung, F-U-N-G, and take the research, the information you find there, and discuss it with your doctors.
Sarah, thank you very, very much for that call. I hope that was helpful to you. And you're always welcome to call here.
Yes, please.
We go now to Dunn in Amarillo, Texas, listening on St. Valentine Radio. Dunn, you have a question for Jimmy?
Yes. First off, thank you for your dedication to the study of the faith. And
thank you.
I read your book, Mass Revision,
mm-hmm.
and anyway, I really appreciate all the study that you did and explanation of prayer positions, gestures, and things like that at Mass, especially with the Olam's position and how it's kind of reserved for the priest at Mass.
in most circumstances.
My question is, I've noticed that a lot of the congregation, when the priest will say, "The Lord be with you," that they will extend their hands towards him mm-hmm. when they respond, "And with your spirit."
Mm-hmm.
And then also during the preface dialogue, when the priest says, "Lift up your hearts," then I've noticed people lift their hands up and say, "We lift them up to the Lord." And I was sort of wondering if that is an appropriate gesture to do.
So it's a very interesting question, and the answer is somewhat ambiguous. There is a regulation of posture and gesture that takes place in Mass, and the law contains two provisions that are relevant here. One of them is it says that the laity are not to use the gestures that are proper to the priest. Unfortunately, it doesn't then go on to give us a list of exactly which gestures are proper to the priest who is celebrating versus which gestures are not. And so it ends up being somewhat debatable in particular cases. For example, when the priest is saying the Lord's Prayer, and he may assume the Orans position where he spreads his hands. Well, a lot of people look at that and say, okay, well, he's the priest. It says for him to do that, so we shouldn't. But the thing is, if you look carefully at the text, the Our Father is not one of what's called the presidential prayers, which are the prayers that are unique to the priest. This is a common prayer that everybody says. And so there's a case to be made canonically that even though at other parts of the Mass, he is the one who should be spreading his hands, that it would be legitimate for the laity to do it here. This is a subject that's been explored, for example, by the canonist Edward Peters, and you can check out his website at canonlaw.info for more info on that. In terms of the kind of natural responses that people do, like if someone is greeting you and they spread their hands, it's kind of natural to spread yours in return. Just like if they stick their hand out to shake your hand, it's natural to stick yours out to reciprocate.
Mm-hmm.
Or if he's saying, "Let's lift up our hearts," and he raises his hands and everybody just kind of spontaneously says, "Oh, we have them up to the Lord," or mm-hmm. Whatever the translation is you're using. Those are kind of spontaneous things. They're not meant to infringe on what he's doing. They're just kind of going with the flow. And my perception at this point is that the Holy See is rather relaxed these days regarding that kind of gesture. Even if you go back a few decades, you'll find notes from the Congregation for Divine Worship saying that we mean these regulations to apply in kind of a broad way, but not to insist on a kind of rigid uniformity that we're trying to protect the role of the priest from the laity, like assuming a priest-like role at Mass, but just answering a gesture by imitating or answering a greeting by making the same gesture back at a person. That's not infringing on his office. So I think the Holy See is taking a somewhat relaxed attitude towards those kind of spontaneous gestures.
Thank you, Dunn. I hope that was helpful. Let's go to Cully from South Florida, listening on the Catholic Answers app. Cully, your question for Jimmy.
Hi. I was asking him about how the Messiah would be of the House of David.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have friends who are Jewish and comparative religion majors.
Mm-hmm.
And they tell me, I obviously believe otherwise. Okay.
By the way, Cully, just so you know, we're like less than a minute or so from a hard break. What's your question?
Okay. Well, I'll be very quick about it then. They've said to me that because there was no marital relations between Joseph and Mary, that there's no way that the child Jesus could be of the house of David because there was no marital relation.
Okay, all right. So here are two possible responses to that. Number one, Jesus was the adopted son of Joseph, and since Joseph was of the line of David, Jesus would therefore have been adopted into the legal line of David. Adoption was a common practice, including royal families. It was often used when there was a need to obtain a male heir when there otherwise wasn't one. And so it was recognized at the time that you could be adopted into a royal line even if you weren't born into it. Second answer is Mary may have also herself been of the line of David. Paul says in Romans that Jesus was descended from David according to the flesh. And although that could mean just in a human way, it could also mean that Mary in particular was of the line of David and thus that Jesus had Davidic descent biologically from her as well. So whether it's legally through Joseph or biologically through Mary, it was quite possible for Jesus to be of the line of David.
Cully, I don't know if you listened to Catholic Answers Focus, but coming up, Jimmy and I have recorded a couple on the nativity narratives of Jesus, and one of them is completely devoted to the genealogies yep. of Jesus and all the cool stuff you can find there. Just go to Catholic.com, click on radio. You'll find under that Focus, and it'll be up in when will it be up? A week or two? Yeah, Nick says a week or two. More Open Forum with Jimmy Akin right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Catch Catholic Answers Live anytime at Catholic.com.
Advent is upon us and Christmas approaches. Catholic Answers wants you to know about our annual Christmas sale with hundreds of great faith-building resources all on sale at 20% off when you enter the promo code CALIVE18 at checkout. With great new products on doctrine, church history, morality, apologetics, and much more, there's simply no better time to stock up on resources to build up your faith and the faith of those around you. Phone 888-291-8000 or go to shop.catholic.com today to take advantage of what is truly the best Catholic sale on the internet going on now through the end of the year. And remember, enter promo code CALIVE18 at checkout and save 20% on hundreds of great resources throughout the store.
Hey everyone, Carlo Broussard here. Did you know that you can arrange for me and a host of other on-fire Catholic Answers speakers to speak at your conference or parish event? Here's how you do it. Go to CatholicAnswersSpeakers.com and you'll find all the information that you need to book me or our other great speakers. That's CatholicAnswersSpeakers.com. We look forward to seeing you.
Have you subscribed to the Catholic Answers Radio Club newsletter? This is Catholic Answers Live host Cy Kellett, and I want to tell you about our new weekly newsletter full of behind-the-scenes information and facts you need to know about the show. It's easy to sign up. Just visit CatholicAnswersLive.com and look for the newsletter sign-up box on the front of the page. It's a great way to keep up to date with what's happening with the show and see what's coming in the days ahead, delivered weekly into your inbox. Sign up today for the Catholic Answers Radio Club newsletter and see what you've been missing. Go to CatholicAnswersLive.com.
Tomorrow on More to Life, our annual on-air Christmas party.
Join the More to Life radio family as we celebrate the season. We promise hijinks will ensue.
Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live Open Forum. Jimmy Akin, our guest this hour, and the questions are completely up to you. Anything having to do with the life, the faith, the history of the Catholic Church is welcome. 888-318-7884 is the number. We go now to Ross in Frankfort, Kentucky, also listening on the Catholic Answers app. Ross, thanks for downloading the Catholic Answers app onto your phone. Your question for Jimmy.
Yes. My question deals with, well, first off, I'm a Baptist, and but I've been doing a lot of research into Catholicism. So my question was about the translation of Genesis 3:15, and I understand the Latin translation translates it as "she will crush the head of the serpent," but a lot of other translations either say "they" or "he." So I wanted your opinion on that and how that affects the possible co-redemptrix role of Mary.
So it's This is something I've written about before. So if you Google Jimmy Akin and Who Will Crush the Serpent's Head, you'll, or Jimmy Akin Genesis 3:15, you'll find more information about this. The passage is, and the translation of the passage is, "She will crush the serpent's head," is not in the original Vulgate. It's not in the original version that St. Jerome translated back in the 4th and 5th centuries. And so it's apparently a reading that got added to the Vulgate at some point in some early editions of it, and then became very common. However, my memory is that if you look at the revised Vulgate that was promulgated by John Paul II, that it doesn't have the reading "She will crush," that it has the standard "He will crush" reading. And similarly, the ordinary Catholic translations, like if you were to look, for example, at the New American Bible Revised Edition, and you look at Genesis 3:15, it says, "I will put enmity between you and the woman, between your offspring and hers. They will strike at your head while you strike at their heel." And so even though you'll find different translations here, and there are different things that can be said about the for and against them, none of them are considered definitive by the Catholic Church. And so it's the Catholic Church would really say it's up to biblical scholars to, you know, discern what the original reading of this text was and how it should be translated. Having said that, it's clear that Mary does have a special role in redemption, and the early church fathers were quick to identify Mary. I mean, this is in second century writings. They were quick to identify Mary as the new Eve. So just as Christ is the new Adam, Mary is the new Eve. And there is a sense in which through Mary, Satan's head was crushed, because it was through Mary that Jesus entered the world and Jesus crushed Satan's head. And so whether or not the reading is original, one can look upon the reading, however it got into some translations, and say, well, it still expresses a theological truth, even if it's not what was meant in the original Hebrew. So really, we don't need, in my view, we don't really need to overly stress about exactly what was the original reading here, because either way you go, it's clear that Jesus was the one who defeated the serpent, but Mary had a unique role in bringing Jesus into the world, and thus Mary had a unique role in defeating the serpent through her son.
How does that strike you, Ross?
That sounds good. Oh, and by the way, I really enjoy your podcast, Jimmy, Mysterious World.
So oh, thank you so much. We've got a lot of great episodes of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World planned coming up.
What about the Doomsday Machine one? Did you get to that one, Ross?
Yeah, I think I've listened to all of them. I've caught up, I think.
Oh,
doesn't
cool.
Doesn't that one frighten you, though? Oh, well. He's thinking about it. Okay, Ross.
This Friday, I have one on Jesus' birth coming up. So that'll
perfect
be nice
timing.
For Christmas.
Yeah. I don't know if you know this, mm-hmm. but we're celebrating that.
Yeah. And then next Friday, we have the hunt for the lost planet Vulcan, which astronomers used to report seeing in our solar system, but they're not reporting seeing it now.
What happened to Vulcan? Nancy from Cleveland. Listening on the Rock Radio. You are up next. Nancy, your question for Jimmy.
Hello. I'm an extraordinary minister, and I recently took communion to somebody. I was always taught that you're just supposed to let Jesus melt in your mouth and then swallow him. And this person chewed it, and I just was like, it just took my breath away because I just thought it was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to the person, I thought we weren't supposed to put our teeth into them.
Mm.
It just kind of scared me. So,
okay. I understand why it would be, why it could be disturbing to you if you hadn't encountered that before. This is really a matter of personal piety. There isn't a church law about this. You will not find statements in canon law or liturgical law saying that you must let the host melt in your mouth, that you must not chew it, or you must wait until it, you know, dissolves to the point that you can safely fold it with your tongue or anything like that. That's simply not part of the church's law. Individual people may have that as part of their personal piety. And if that's a way that you show respect and reverence for Jesus, then that's fine. But it's not required for other people to do that. And in fact, in some rites of the church, like some of the Eastern rites that use leavened bread, you wouldn't get to the point of necessarily of having a complete dissolution of the host. And furthermore, much more significant things than what happens with your teeth are going to happen to the accidents of the host anyway, as soon as you swallow it. And it's already being partially dissolved by the enzymes in your mouth, and then it's going to hit your stomach acid and the accidents are going to be dissolved. But that's the important thing to bear in mind here. Even though Jesus is really present, he's not being hurt. He's not being dissolved, whether you chew the host vigorously or whether you let it soften due to moisture and enzymes. He's not being hurt one way or the other. It's simply the accidents or appearances of the of bread that are being dealt with, whether by your teeth or your tongue or your saliva or your stomach acid. It's the accidents that are being affected, not Jesus. Jesus is glorified in heaven, and he's not injured in any way by what happens. And so consequently, it's a matter of personal piety whether you want to chew or not chew, and the church has no law on that. And consequently, even though I understand that if you're coming from one of those pious perspectives, that it can be disorienting to encounter someone who has a different sense of piety. But as St. Paul indicates, we should, in matters where we have liberty like this, we should refrain, you know, from thinking ill of each other and respecting the differences in piety that other people have.
Okay, Nancy?
Gotcha. Thank you so much.
Thank you very, very
much.
Thank you. 888-318-7884, the number here. It is open forum, and you are welcome to call if you have a question about the Catholic faith. Whether you're Catholic or not, you're welcome to call. 888-318-7884. We go now to Jose in Tampa, Florida, listening on the Catholic Answers app. Jose, your question for Jimmy.
Hi, my question is about Santa Claus.
Okay.
As a Catholic family, is it okay to celebrate Christmas including Santa Claus in the way of, you know, like telling my girls that Santa Claus is real and he gives presents to all the good kids? My wife actually feels like she will be lying to them by telling them mm-hmm. that Santa is real. And if it's not okay, what can I do to explain, especially my family, that they have so high hopes of doing the whole Santa Claus thing with them since, mm-hmm. you know, is the first granddaughters that are really, really young.
Okay. this is a subject on which different people have different opinions, and so I leave it to individual families to figure out the way they're going to do it. Personally, I am not comfortable with a society-wide Santa Claus hoax where we tell children that Santa Claus is real and does these magical things and so forth. Other people have defended it on the grounds that children who are this young are not able, they're not moral agents yet, and so you're not going to be leading them into sin by lying to them about such matters. However, I tend to think, and this is just me personally, and I'm not judging anybody who thinks otherwise, I tend to think that honesty is the best policy, and that even if you lie to children about Santa Claus as kind of a game early on, at some point they're going to learn that Santa Claus does not work the way that society depicts it as working. And so, you know, sometimes kids will feel let down by that. They'll feel lied to once they realize it. And they may in later years even use that as a justification for rejecting other things their parents tell them. And so my thought, if if I ever had children, it would be, we're not going to participate in the Santa Claus hoax. Now, that doesn't mean we wouldn't find ways of incorporating Santa Claus into Christmas celebrations. There was a real St. Nicholas who lived in the 300s in what's now Turkey. He was one of the participants at the First Council of Nicaea that defined the divinity of Christ. And so talking about the historical St. Nicholas is totally fine. And in that sense, you can say there is a Santa Claus. In terms of him flying around the world with reindeer and giving presents to people and so forth, I wouldn't even necessarily exclude, like, you know, I having an appearance by Santa Claus at a Christmas party, and very small children are not going to understand what's going on anyway. They're just going to know this is colorful and fun. But
especially if some kind of gift or sweet comes with it.
Exactly. But I would be inclined to, as quickly as possible, as soon as a child is able to understand, help them understand this is a game. That this is a game we play for fun. And so you can have the Santa Claus game and you can have fun with it as a family. I just wouldn't be inclined to tell children this is literally real. But that's my opinion. Other people have their own.
There's no official church document.
There's no official church document on this. We have to apply the principles of moral theology as best we can.
Jose, thank you very, very much for that call. Right now, we've got a free ebook available. If you go to the Catholic Answers Facebook page, they've been doing these free ebooks, and we'd love to give them to you. There's one right now called Seeking the Star of Bethlehem. You can get your free copy just by going to the Catholic Answers Facebook page, find the little pinned advertisement or whatever you call it for it. You can have that free ebook right now on the Catholic Answers Facebook page, Seeking the Star of Bethlehem.
Call us now with your question. Hello? On Catholic Answers Live.
He is only one of four popes honored as the great.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
St. Leo I was pope at a time when Roman civilization was being overrun by barbarian armies. He stood as a light in the darkness and even saved the city of Rome from destruction by Attila and the Huns. Leo died in 461.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
St. Paul's street evangelization isn't like other evangelism you might have seen on the streets. We don't yell, and we don't force anyone to pay attention to us. Instead, St. Paul's street evangelization is committed to presenting a positive, passionately Catholic presence to a world hungry for truth. For more information, or to start a chapter of your own, go to www.streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com. It's time to do our part.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, Open Forum. Jimmy Akin, our guest, and lots and lots of folks on the line, so we will work our way through them. John from Cincinnati, Ohio, listening on Sacred Heart Radio. You are up next. John, your question.
Hey, how are you today?
Great, John.
All right. Well, my question is about something that I recently had a term put to. I have always grown up believing that the church taught us, I'm Catholic myself, mm-hmm. that in the end, Christ's desire for unity is such that our efforts at ecumenicism should be to eventually convert the whole world to believe in Jesus through the fullness of truth with the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. But someone recently described that to me as being called the ecumenism of return and said that the church no longer teaches that. So I'm trying to find out what's true.
Well, You will have people who say things like that, who say that the church doesn't teach the ecumenism of return or things like that. I think that that's a misguided way of approaching the subject, or at least it's not the best way to express the truth in this area. The truth is, Jesus said right at the end of Matthew's gospel that his church was to go into all the world and make converts of all the nations, of all the Gentiles, teaching them to observe whatever he has commanded us. And so he indicates that this mission is directed at all the world, at everybody. And secondly, he's indicated that it is to communicate everything that he has taught us. And so the fullness of the faith, it is not an option to say, oh, we don't want to share the fullness of the truth with some group of people, or we don't want to encourage them to embrace it. To adopt attitudes like that would be to refuse the Great Commission. And that's simply inconsistent with the mandate that Christ gave us. So I would say we have a mandate from Jesus Christ to share all of the truth with all of the people. Now, having said that, there is a practical question of how much unity and can we achieve in given cases, and what's likely to happen before the second coming, whenever that might be. And there may be some situations where you say, okay, the best way, because even though it's God's will to have all people in communion with his church and in the fullness of the truth, we're not given to understand from the Bible that that's actually going to become a reality by the second coming. In fact, we have pretty strong indications that the church will have opponents that are persecuting it at the time of the second coming. And so consequently, we shouldn't necessarily assume that this is going to be achievable in any particular case. A given person has free will. A movement is made up of people. We may or may not be able to achieve full reconciliation with a given group of people. We'll have to see in particular circumstances. And we may or may not find it advantageous to share particular bits of truth with people at a particular moment. Jesus himself in John's gospel tells even the disciples themselves, I have many things to say to you that you cannot now bear. So Jesus himself recognized that there's a time and a season for putting an emphasis on certain truths, and it's not always an opportune time to talk about every single thing. And so consequently, we have to exercise prudence in dealing with other people, whether they're non-Christians, whether they're fellow Christians but who belong to a different theological tradition. The overarching goal still needs to be the Great Commission. It still needs to be share all the truth with all the people, but and encourage them to accept it because it's true. But in particular situations, there can be sort of tactical or strategic questions about what's the best way to approach this person or this group of people right now. How can we best help them grow closer to God in this situation? And that may or may not mean an immediate invitation for them to become Catholic. Oftentimes, for them to be receptive to becoming Catholic, there's some preparation that has to be made. And just like when you're proposing marriage to someone, you don't want to do that on the first date because it would be scary and intimidating. In the same way, when you first meet somebody and you're befriending them and you're starting to talk to them and share the truth with them, you don't want to immediately demand that they become Catholic. And the same thing is true not just of individuals but of movements that you're working with. And so it can be legitimate to go slow in some of these things and trust that God will guide this relationship in the future, even though we do need to keep the overall goal of sharing all of the truth with everybody in mind. One thing that I think is kind of open for discussion is whether the use of the term return is the best term to be used in some of these situations. Return, even though it does express a truth with regard to, say, a group of Christians that has left full communion with the Catholic Church and then achieves reconciliation with it, framing it in terms of return could actually, it expresses a truth, but it's not the only way to express what's happening there. You can also frame things not in terms of like, well, you need to return, but which implies a fault on the part of somebody.
Yeah.
You can all, especially when they weren't even the person who committed the fault of leaving communion, that was their ancestors maybe centuries ago.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not to blame for it. Instead, it can be framed in terms of, let's proceed together and see about can we establish full communion with each other? And that doesn't put the fault on anybody, but it also expresses a truth of if we can come to full agreement on all of these different points, then we will discover that we, in fact, are in full communion with each other and don't need to remain separated any longer.
Okie dokie. I hope that that was helpful to you. John, I beg your pardon. I had a little
John
brain
from Cincinnati.
Had a brain cramp for a second there, John. We'll go to Joe from Cleveland, Ohio, listening on the Catholic Answers app next. Joe, your question for Jimmy.
Hi. I have a question.
Okay.
What was Mary's role in the early church when she was still alive?
Well, she was honored as being Jesus' mother, and she was a respected figure that people paid their respects to and looked up to. We see her worshiping with the gathering of 120 people on the day of Pentecost. She was then cared for by the beloved disciple John. And we're not told a whole lot else about what happened with her in Scripture. She obviously passed on stories about Jesus that she knew. Luke, in his gospel, twice refers in his infancy narratives, that's the first two chapters of Luke, he refers to how Mary remembered these things that he's writing down. So obviously he either got them directly from her or from someone who had talked to her. So we know Mary continued to pass on the stories of what had happened with Jesus when he was a boy. So she was a source of information. She was someone who was venerated, who was respected by other Christians, and she participated in the life and worship of the church as a Christian.
Okay, Joe?
Okay, I also have one more question.
Okay.
What's that?
Is it true that she appealed to St. James in Spain when she was still alive? I think it's from Our Lady of the Pillar.
Yeah, this is something that we don't have solid historical evidence for one way or another. Over the course of time, there have been a lot of stories told about the saints, and some of them have a solid historical basis, and others we don't have information that really proves them, and this is one that goes in that latter category. But there are other stories about the saints that are very definitely historical and that we do have good information on.
Okay, Joe?
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for that call. Again, it is open forum here on Catholic Answers Live. We welcome your call at 888-31-TRUTH. Let's go to Natalie from Florida listening on YouTube Live. What a name for this time of year, Natalie. Happy to have you with us. Your question for Jimmy.
Hi. So a friend of mine has recently joined a denomination that has a lot of far-out beliefs. And our conversations keep getting stuck on the fact that we don't hold to the Sabbath, even though it's a commandment.
Okay.
And they really strongly hold that the Lord's Day.
By the way, just so you know, we're about 2 minutes away from a hard break. So can you give me your question? I want to give you a good answer.
Sure, yeah. Just the Lord's Day, they don't really believe that that refers to Sunday. So how do we explain why we don't celebrate Sabbath?
Okay. One of the things that there's a lot I could say here, and I would suggest going to Catholic.com and typing in the word Sabbath. You'll find additional information about this that'll be more than what I am able to go into right now. But one of the things I would point out is there is no natural law that says this day is suddenly holy. That's established by religious law, but it's not established by natural law. Saturday is just a space of time like any other day is just a space of time. And so it's really religious law that establishes one day is holy and another is less holy. In terms of what is obligatory for Christians to celebrate, we are not obliged to celebrate the ritual requirements of the Mosaic law, things like circumcision and food laws and Sabbaths. And that's something that's made clear in the Epistle to the Colossians by St. Paul. If you look in chapter 2, he talks about how the various observances of the Mosaic law were like a shadow pointing forward to Christ. But now that Christ is here, those observances are no longer required, even of the Jewish people. And so he says, therefore, let no one judge you in meat or drink or in a Sabbath or a new moon or a festival. Sabbath, new moons, and festivals being the three kinds of holy days in the Jewish liturgical calendar. And so that's why Christians celebrate the Lord's Day as the day of Christ's resurrection, the eighth day, not the seventh day Sabbath. And you can read more about that at Catholic.com. Just type in Sabbath.
Natalie, thanks very, very much for that call. It remains open forum. And guess what? Jimmy's going to stay with us for another hour. So we get to enjoy Jimmy's very colorful presence and helpful presence for another hour. If you haven't called, the number is 888-318-7884. If you're already on the line, hang on. We're going to get to that call when we come back right after this on Catholic Answers Live.